Chapter 7. En route to Delta Pavonis, 2546. Never quite forgetting that she was aboard a ship, it was the ever-so-slightly irregular pattern of the induced gravity, caused by tiny imbalances in the thrust stream, which in turn reflected mysterious quantum capriciousness in the bowels of the conjoiner drives. Volyova entered the green seclusion of the glade alone, and hesitated at the top of the rustic staircase which ambled down to the grass. If Sajaki was aware of her presence, he chose not to show it, kneeling silently and motionlessly next to the gnarled tree stump, which was their informal meeting place. But he undoubtedly sensed her. Volyova knew that Sajaki had visited the pattern jugglers on the aquatic world Wintersea, accompanying Captain Brannigan, back when Captain Brannigan was capable of leaving the ship. She did not know what the purpose of that trip had been, for either of them, but there had been rumors that the pattern jugglers had tampered with his neocortex, embossing neural patterns which configured an unusual degree of spatial awareness, the ability to think in four or five dimensions. The patterns had been the rarest kind of juggler transform, one that lingered. Volyova ambled down the staircase and allowed her foot to creak on the lowest tread. Sajaki turned to regard her with no visible hint of surprise. "Something up?" he asked, reading her expression. "It concerns the Stavlonik," she said, momentarily lapsing back into Russish. "The protégé, I mean." "Tell me about it," Sajaki said absently. He wore an ash-gray kimono, damp grass darkening his knees to olive black. His kamuso's shakuhachi rested on the stump's mirror-smooth, elbow-polished surface. He and Volyova were now the only two crew members yet to enter reefer sleep, 2 months out from Yellowstone. "She's one of us now," Volyova said, kneeling opposite him. "The core of her indoctrination is complete. I welcome this news." Across the glade, a macaw screeched, then left its perch in a flurry of clashing primary colors. "We can introduce her to Captain Brannigan. No time like the present," Sajaki said, smoothing a wrinkle from his kimono. "Or do you have second thoughts about meeting the captain?" She clucked nervously. "None at all." "Then it's deeper than that." "What?" "Whatever's on your mind, Ilya. Come on, spit it out." "It's Kuri. I'm no longer willing to risk her suffering the same kind of psychotic episodes as Nagorny." She stopped, expecting, hoping even, for some response from Sajaki. But instead all she got was the white noise of the waterfall, and a total absence of expression on her crewmate's face. "What I mean," she continued, almost stammering with her own uncertainty, "is that I'm no longer sure she's a suitable subject at this stage." "At this stage?" Sajaki spoke so softly, she largely read his lips. "I mean, to go into the gunnery immediately after Nagorny. It's too dangerous, and I think Kuri is too valuable to risk." She stopped, swallowed, and drew breath into her lungs for what she knew would be the hardest thing to say. "I think we need another recruit, someone less gifted. With an intermediate recruit, I can iron out the remaining wrinkles before going ahead with Kuri as primary candidate." Sajaki picked up his shakuhachi and sighted along it thoughtfully. There was a little raised burr at the end of the bamboo, perhaps from the time when he had used the stick on Kuri. He rubbed it with his thumb, smoothing it back down. When he spoke, it was with a calm so total that it was worse than any possible display of anger.
"You're suggesting we look for another recruit?"
He made it sound as if what she was proposing was easily the most absurd, deranged thing he had ever heard uttered.
"Only in the interim," she said, aware that she was speaking too quickly, hating herself for it, despising her sudden deference to the man. "Just until everything's stable. Then we can use Kuri."
Sajaki nodded.
"Well, that sounds sensible. Goodness knows why we didn't think of it earlier, but I suppose we had other things on our minds."
He put down the shakuhachi, although his hand did not stray far from its hollow shaft.
"But that can't be helped. What we have to do now is find ourselves another recruit. Shouldn't be too hard, should it? I mean, we hardly taxed ourselves recruiting Kuri. Admittedly, we're 2 months into interstellar space, and our next port of call is a virtually unheard-of outpost, but I don't envisage any great problem in finding another subject. I expect we'll have to turn them away in droves, don't you? Be reasonable, she said. In what sense am I being anything other than reasonable, Triumvir? A moment ago she had been scared. Now she was angry. You haven't been the same, Yuji-san. Not since what? Not since you and the captain visited the jugglers. What happened there, Yuji? What did the aliens do to your head? He looked at her oddly, as if the question were a perfectly valid one, which it had never struck him to ask himself. It was, fatefully, a ruse. Sajaki moved quickly with the shakuhachi, so that all Valyova really saw was a teak-colored blur in the air. The blow was relatively soft. Sajaki must have pulled at the last moment, but gashing into her side, it was still sufficient to send her sprawling into the grass. For the first instant, it was not the pain or the shock of being attacked by Sajaki that overwhelmed her, but the prickly cold wetness of the grass brushing against her nostrils. He stepped casually round the stump. "You're always asking too many questions," Sajaki said, and then drew something from his kimono that might have been a syringe. Nekebet Isthmus, Resurgum, 2566. Sylvest reached anxiously into his pocket, feeling for the vial which he felt sure would be missing. He touched it. A minor miracle. Down below, dignitaries were filing into the Amarantine city, moving slowly towards the temple at the city's heart. Snatches of their conversation reached him with perfect clarity, though never long enough for him to hear more than a few words. He was hundreds of meters above them, on the human-installed balustrade, which had been grafted to the black wall of the city englobing egg. It was his wedding day. He had seen the temple in simulations many times, but it had been so long since he had actually visited the place that he had forgotten how overpowering its size could be. That was one of the odd, persistent defects of simulations. No matter how precise they became, the participant remained aware that they were not reality. Sylvest had stood beneath the roof of the Amarantine Spire Temple, gazing up to where the angled stone arches intersected hundreds of meters above, and had felt not the slightest hint of vertigo, or fear that the age-old structure would choose that moment to collapse upon him. But now, visiting the buried city for only the second time in person, he felt a withering sense of his own smallness. The egg in which it was encased was itself uncomfortably large, but that at least was the product of a recognizably mature technology, even if the inundationists elected to ignore the fact. The city which rested within, on the other hand, looked more like the product of some 15th-century fever dream fantasist, not least because of the fabulous winged figure which rested atop the temple's spire. And all of it, the more he looked, seemed to exist only to celebrate the return of the banished ones. None of it made sense, but at least it forced his mind off the ceremony ahead. The more he looked, the more he realized, against his first impression, that the winged thing really was an Amarantine, or more accurately, a kind of hybrid Amarantine angel, sculpted by an artist with a deep and scholarly understanding of what the possessing of wings would actually entail. Seen without his eye's zoom facility, the statue was cruciform, shockingly so. Enlarged, the cruciform shape became a perched Amarantine with glorious outspread wings. The wings were metalled in different colours, each small trailing feather sparkling with a slightly different hue. Like the human representation of an angel, the wings did not simply replace the creature's arms, but were a third pair of limbs in their own right. But the statue seemed more real than any representation of an angel Sylvest had ever seen in human art. It appeared, the thought seemed absurd, anatomically correct. The sculptor had not just grafted the wings onto the basic Amarantine form, but had subtly re-engineered the creature's underlying physique. The manipulatory forelimbs had been moved slightly lower down the torso, elongated to compensate. The chest of the torso swelled much wider than the norm, dominated by a yoke-like skeletal muscular form around the creature's shoulder area. From this yoke sprouted the wing, forming a roughly triangular shape, kite-like. The creature's neck was longer than normal, and the head seemed even more streamlined and avian in profile. The eyes still faced forwards, though like all Amarantine, its binocular vision was limited. but were set into deep, grooved bone channels. The creature's upper mandible nostril parts were flared and rilled, as if to draw the extra air into the lungs required for the beating of the wings. And yet, not everything was right. Assuming that the creature's body was approximately similar in mass to the Amarantine norm, even those wings would have been pitifully inadequate for the task of flying. So what were they? Some kind of gross ornamentation? Had the banished ones gone in for radical bioengineering, only to burden themselves with wings of ridiculous impracticality? Or had there been another purpose? Second thoughts? Sylvester was jolted suddenly from his contemplation. You still don't think this is a good idea, do you? He turned around from the balustrade which looked across the city. It's a little late to voice my objections, I think. On your wedding day? Girardio smiled. Well, you're not home and dry yet, then. You could always back out. How would you take that? Very badly indeed, I suspect. Girardio was dressed in starched city finery, cheeks lightly rouged for the attendant swarms of float cams. He took Sylvester by the forearm and led him away from the edge. How long have we been friends, then? I wouldn't exactly call it friendship. More a kind of mutual parasitism. Oh, come on, Girardio said, looking disappointed. Have I made your life any more of a misery these last 20 years than was strictly necessary? Do you think I took any great pleasure in locking you away? Let's say you approached the task with no little enthusiasm, only because I had your best interests at heart. They stepped off the balcony into one of the low tunnels which threaded the black shell around the city. Cushioned flooring absorbed their footsteps. Besides, Girardio continued, if it wasn't transparently obvious then, there was something of a feeding frenzy at the time. If I hadn't put you in custody, some mob would eventually have taken out their anger on you. Sylvester listened without speaking. He knew much of what Girardio said was true on a theoretical level, but that there was no guarantee that it reflected the man's actual motives at the time. The political situation at the time was much simpler. Back then we didn't have Troupath making trouble. They reached an elevator shaft and entered the carriage, its interior antiseptically clean and new. Prints hung on the wall, showing various resurgent vistas before and after the inundationist transformations. There was even one of Mantell. The mesa in which the research outpost was embedded was draped in foliage, a waterfall running off the top, blue, cloud-streaked skies beyond it. In Cuvier, there was a whole sub-industry devoted to creating images and simulations of the future resurgem, ranging from watercolor artists to skilled sensorium designers. And on the other hand, Girardio said, there are radical scientific elements coming out of the woodwork. Only last week, one of Troupath's representatives was shot dead in Mantell, and believe me, it wasn't one of our agents who did it. Sylvester felt the carriage begin to convey them down, towards the city level. What are you saying? I'm saying that with fanatics on both sides, you and I are beginning to look like distinct moderates. Depressing thought, isn't it? Out-radicalized on both fronts, you mean? Something like that. They emerged through the black graven wall of the city shell into a small crowd of media types who were running through last-minute preparations for the event. Reporters wore buff-colored float cam glasses, choreographing the cams which hovered around them like drab party balloons. One of Jannikin's genetically engineered peacocks was pecking around the group, its tail hissing behind it. Two security officers stepped forward, garbed in black with gold inundationist sigils on their shoulders, surrounded by flocks of deliberately threatening entoptics. Servitors loitered behind them. They ran full-spectrum ident scans on Sylvester and Girardio, then motioned them to a small temporary structure which had been placed near a nest-like froth of Amarantine dwellings. The inside was almost bare, apart from a table and two skeletal chairs. There was a bottle of Americano red wine on the table, next to a pair of wine goblets, engraved with frosted glass landscapes. Sit down, Girardio said. He swaggered around the table and decanted measures of wine into both glasses. I don't know why you're so damned nervous. It isn't as if this is your first time. My fourth, actually. All stoner ceremonies? Sylvester nodded. He thought of the first two. Small-scale affairs, to minor league stoner women, the faces of whom he could almost not separate in his memory. Both had withered under the glare of publicity that the family name attracted. By contrast, his marriage to Alicia, his last wife, had been sculpted as a publicity move from the onset. It had focused attention on the upcoming Resurgam expedition, giving it the final monetary push it needed. The fact that they had been in love had been almost inconsequential, merely a happy addendum to the existing arrangement. "That's a lot of baggage to be carrying around in your head now," Girardio said. "Don't you ever wish you could be rid of the past each time? You find the ceremony unusual. Perhaps I do." Girardio wiped a red smear of wine from his lips. "I was never part of stoner culture, you see.
You came with us from Yellowstone."
"Yes, but I wasn't born there. My family were from Grand Teton. I only arrived on Yellowstone 7 years before the Resurgam expedition departed. Not really enough time to become culturally adapted to stoner tradition. My daughter, on the other hand, well, Pascal's never known anything but stoner society, or at least the version of it we imported when we came here." He lowered his voice. "You must have the vial with you now, I suppose. May I see it? I could hardly refuse you."
Sylvester reached in his pocket and removed the little glass cylinder he had been carrying with him all day. He passed it to Girardio, who nervously tinkered with it, tipping it this way and that. He watched the bubbles within, slipping to and fro as if in a spirit level. Something darker hung within the fluid, fibrous and tendrilled. He placed the vial down. It made a delicate glassy chime as it settled on the tabletop. Girardio studied it with barely masked horror.
"Was it painful?"
"Of course not. We're not sadists, you know."
Sylvester smiled, secretly enjoying Girardio's discomfort.
"Would you rather we exchanged camels, perhaps? Put it away."
Sylvester slipped the vial back into his pocket.
"Now tell me who's the nervous one, Nils."
Girardio poured himself another measure of wine.
"Sorry, security are edgy as hell. Don't know what's got them so bothered, but it's rubbing off on me, I suppose."
"I didn't notice anything."
"You wouldn't."
Girardio shrugged, a bellows-like movement that began somewhere below his abdomen.
"They claim everything's normal, but after 20 years, I read them better than they imagine."
"I wouldn't worry. Your police are very efficient people."
Girardio shook his head briefly, as if he had taken a bite from a particularly sour lemon.
"I don't expect the air between us to ever be completely cleared, Dan, but you could at least give me the benefit of the doubt."
He nodded towards the open door.
"Didn't I give you complete access to this place?"
"Yes, and all that had done was to replace 12 questions with 1,000 more."
"Nils," he began, "how are the colony's resources these days?"
"In what sense?"
"I know things have been different since Remiliod came through. Things which would have been unthinkable in my day could be done now if the political will was there."
"What kinds of things?"
Girardio asked dubiously. Sylvester reached into his jacket again, but this time instead of the vial, he removed a piece of paper which he spread before Girardio. The paper was marked with complex circular figures.
"You recognize these marks?
We found them on the obelisk and all over the city. They are maps of the solar system, made by the Amaranthin.
Somehow, having seen this city, I find that easier to believe now than I once did."
"Good. Then hear me out."
Sylvester drew his finger along the widest circle.
"This represents the orbit of the neutron star, Hades."
"Hades?"
"That was the name it was given when they first surveyed the system. There's a lump of rock orbiting it too, about the size of a planetary moon. They call it Cerberus."
Then he brushed his finger across the cluster of graphic forms attending the neutron star planet double system. "Somehow this was important to the Amaranthin, and I think it might have some bearing on the event."
Girardio buried his head in his hands theatrically, then looked back at Sylvester.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
"Yes."
Carefully, never allowing his gaze to move from Girardio's eyes, he folded away the paper and replaced it in his pocket.
"We have to explore it and find out what killed the Amaranthin before it kills us as well."
When Sajaki and Volyova came to Kuri's quarters, they told her to put on something warm.
Curry noticed that they were both wearing heavier-than-usual shipwear. Volyova in a zipped-up flying jacket, Sajaki in muffled, high-collared thermals, quilted in a mosaic of Nova Diamond patches. "I've screwed up, haven't I?" Curry said. "This is where I get the airlock treatment. My scores in the combat simulations haven't been good enough. You're going to ditch me."
"Don't be stupid," Sajaki said, only his nose and forehead protruding above the fur line of his collar. "If we were going to kill you, do you think we'd worry about you catching a chill?"
"And," Volyova said, "your indoctrination finished weeks ago. You're now one of our assets. To kill you now would be a form of treason against ourselves." Beneath the bib of her cap, only her mouth and chin were visible. She exactly complimented Sajaki, the two of them forming one bland, composite face.
"Nice to know you care."
Still unsure of her position, the possibility that they might be planning something nasty was still looming large, she dug through what passed for her belongings until she found a thermal jacket. Manufactured by the ship, it was similar to Sajaki's harlequin job, except that it fell almost to her knees. An elevator journey took them into an unexplored region of the ship, at least well away from what Curry considered known territory. They had to change elevators several times, walking through interconnecting tunnels, which Volyova said were necessary because of virus damage taking out large sections of the transit system. The decor and technological level of the walkthrough areas was always subtly different, suggesting to Curry that whole districts of the ship had been left fallow at different stages over the last few centuries. She remained nervous, but something in Sajaki and Volyova's demeanor told her that what they had in mind was more akin to an initiation ceremony than a cold execution. They reminded her of children embarked on some piece of malicious tomfoolery. Volyova, at least, though Sajaki looked and acted a good deal more authoritarian, like a functionary carrying out a grim civic duty.
"Since you're part of us now," he said, "it's time you learned a little more about the setup. You might also appreciate knowing our reason for going to Resurgam.
I assumed it was trade."
"That was the cover story. But let's face it was never very convincing. Resurgam doesn't have much in the way of an economy. The purpose of the colony is pure research, and it certainly lacks the resources to buy much from us. Of course, our data on the colony is necessarily old, and once we're there, we'll trade what we can. But that could never be the sole reason for our voyage there.
So what is?"
The lift they were in was decelerating. "The name Sylvest mean anything to you?"
Sajaki asked. Curry did her best to act normally, as if the question were reasonable, and not one which had gone off in her cranium like a magnesium flare.
"Well, of course. Everyone on Yellowstone knew about Sylvest. Guy was practically a god to them, or maybe the devil."
She paused, hoping her reaction sounded normal.
"Wait, though. Which Sylvest are we talking about here? The older one? The guy who botched up those immortality experiments? Or his son?"
"Technically speaking," Sajaki said, "both." The lift thundered to a halt. When the doors opened, it was like being slapped in the face with a cold, wet cloth. Curry was glad for the advice about the warm clothes, although she still felt mortally chilled.
"Thing was," she continued, "they weren't all bastards. Lorian was the old guy's father, and he was still some kind of a folk hero, even after he died. And the old guy, what was his name again? Calvin, right? Even after Calvin killed all those people. Then Calvin's son came along, Dan, that would have been, and he tried to make amends in his own way with the Shrouder thing."
Curry shrugged. "I wasn't around then, of course. I only know what people told me."
Sajaki led them through gloomy gray-green-lit corridors, huge and perhaps mutant janitor rats scrabbling away as their footfalls neared. What he took them into resembled the inside of a choleraic trachea, corridors thick and glutinous with dirty, carapacial ice, venous with buried tentacular ducts and power lines, slick with something nastily like human phlegm. Ship slime, Volyova called it, an organic secretion caused by malfunctioning biological recycler systems on an adjacent level.
Mostly, though, it was the cold of which Curry took heed.
"Sylvest's part in things is rather complex," Sajaki said. "It'll take a while to explain.
First, though, I'd like you to meet the captain.
Sylvester walked around himself, checking that nothing was seriously out of place. Satisfied, he cancelled the image and joined Girardio in the prefab's anteroom. The music reached a crescendo, then settled into a burbling refrain. The pattern of lights altered, voices dropping to a hush. Together they stepped into the glare, into the basso sound field of the organ's drone. A meandering path led to the central temple, carpeted for the occasion. Chime trees lined it, cased in protective domes of clear plastic. The chime trees were spindly articulated sculptures, their many arms tipped with curved, colored mirrors. At odd times, the trees would click and reconfigure themselves, moved by what seemed to be million-year-old clockwork buried in pedestals. Current thinking had it that the trees were elements of some citywide semaphore system. The organ's noise magnified as they stepped into the temple. Its egg-shaped dome was permeated by petal-shaped expanses of elaborate stained glass, miraculously intact despite the slow predations of time and gravity. Filtered through the top lights, the air in the temple seemed suffused with a calming pink radiance. The central portion of the enormous room was taken up by the rising foundation of the spire, which rose above the temple, wide and flared like the base of a sequoia. Temporary seating for 100 top-level Cuvier dignitaries bowed out in a fan shape from one side of the pillar, easily accommodated by the building, despite its one-quarter scale. Sylvester scanned the racks of watchers, recognizing about a third of them. Perhaps a tenth had been his allies before the coup. Most of them wore heavy outer garments, plump with furs. He recognized Janaquin amongst them, sage-like with his smoke-white goatee and long silvery hair waterfalling from his bald pate. He looked more simian than ever. Some of his birds were in the hall, released from a dozen bamboo boxes. Sylvester had to admit that they were now strikingly good facsimiles, even down to the bobbed crest and the speckled shimmer of their turquoise plumage. They had been adapted from chickens by careful manipulation of homeobox genes. The audience, many of whom had not seen the birds before today, applauded. Janaquin turned the color of bloodied snow and seemed anxious to sink into his brocade overcoat. Girardio and Sylvester reached a sturdy table at the focus of the audience. The table was ancient, its woodwork eagle and Latinate inscriptions dated back to the Americano settlers on Yellowstone. Its corners were chipped. A varnished mahogany box sat on the table, sealed by delicate gold clasps. A woman of serious demeanor stood behind the table, dressed in an electric white gown. The gown's clasp was a complex dual sigil, combining the Resurgium City inundationist governmental seal with the emblem of the Mixmasters, two hands holding a cat's cradle of DNA. She was, Sylvester knew, not a true Mixmaster. The Mixmasters were a cliquish guild of stoner bioengineers and geneticists, and none of their sanctum had journeyed to Resurgium. Yet their symbol, which had travelled, denoted general expertise in life sciences, gene sculpting, surgery, or medicine. Her unsmiling face was sallow in the stained light, hair collected in a bun, pierced by two syringes. The music quietened. "I am Ordinator Massinger," she said, voice ringing out across the chamber. "I am empowered by the Resurgium Expeditionary Council to marry individuals of this settlement, unless such union conflicts with the genetic fitness of the colony." The Ordinator opened the mahogany box. Just below the lid lay a leather-bound object, the size of a Bible. She removed it and placed it on the table, then folded it open with a creak of leather. The exposed surfaces were matte grey, like wet slate, glistening with microscopic machinery. "Place one hand each on the page nearest you, gentlemen." They placed their palms on the surface. There was a fluorescent sweep as the book took their palm prints, followed by a brief tingle as biopsies were taken. When they were done, Massinger took the book and pressed her own hand against the surface. Massinger then asked Nils Girardio to state his identity to the gathered. Sylvester watched faint smiles ghost the audience. There was something absurd about it, after all, though Girardio made no show of this himself. Then she asked the same of Sylvester.
I am Daniel Calvin Laurien Soutain-Sylvestre, he said, using the form of his name so rarely employed that it almost took an effort of memory to bring it to mind. He went on, the only biological son of Rosaline Soutain and Calvin Sylvestre, both of Chasm City, Yellowstone. I was born on the 17th of January, in the 121st standard year after the resettlement of Yellowstone. My calendrical age is 215. Allowing for medicine programs, I have a physiological age of 60, on the Sharavi scale. How do you knowingly manifest? I knowingly manifest in one incarnation only, the biological form now speaking. And you affirm that you are not wittingly manifested via alpha level or other Turing-capable simulacra in this or any other solar system, none of which I am aware. Massinger made small annotations in the book, using a pressure stylus. She had asked Girardio precisely the same questions, standard parts of the Stoner ceremony. Ever since the 80s, Stoners had been intensely suspicious of simulations in general, particularly those that purported to contain the essence or soul of an individual. One thing they especially disliked was the idea of one manifestation of an individual, biological or otherwise, making contracts to which the other manifestations were not bound, such as marriage. These details are in order, Massinger said. The bride may step forward. Pascal moved into the roseate light. She was accompanied by two women wearing ash-colored wimples, a squad of float cams and personal security wasps, and a semi-transparent entourage of entoptics, nymphs, seraphim, flying fish and hummingbirds, star-glittered dewdrops and butterflies, in slow cascade around her wedding dress. The most exclusive entoptic designers in Cuvier had created them. Girardio raised his thick, Hauser-like arms and bid his daughter forward. You look beautiful, he murmured. What Sylvestre saw was beauty reduced to digital perfection. He knew that Girardio saw something incomparably softer and more human, like the difference between a swan and a hard glass sculpture of a swan. Place your hand on the book, the ordinator said. An imprint of moisture from Sylvestre's hand was still visible, like a wider shoreline around Pascal's island of pale flesh. The ordinator asked her to verify her identity in the same manner as she had asked Girardio and Sylvestre. Pascal's task was simple enough. Not only had she been born on Resurgam, but she had never left the planet. Ordinator Massinger delved deeper into the mahogany box. While she did so, Sylvestre's eyes worked the audience. He saw Janikin, looking paler than ever, fidgety. Deep within the box, polished to a bluish antiseptic luster, lay a device like a cross between an old-style pistol and a veterinarian's hypodermic. Behold the wedding gun, the ordinator said, holding the box aloft. Bone splinteringly cold as it was, Curry soon stopped noticing the temperature except as an abstract quality of the air. The story that her two crewmates was relating was far too strange for that. They were standing near the captain. His name, she now knew, was John Armstrong Brannigan. He was old, inconceivably so. Depending on the system one adopted in measuring his age, he was anywhere between 200 and 500 years old. The details of his birth were unclear now, hopelessly tangled in the countertruths of political history. Mars, some said, was the place where he had been born, yet it was equally possible that he had been born on Earth, Earth's city-jammed moon, or in any one of the several hundred habitats which drifted through cislunar space in those days. He was already over a century old before he ever left Sol system, Sir Jarki said. He waited until it was possible to do so, then was among the first 1,000 to leave, when the conjoiners launched the first ship from Phobos. At least someone called John Brannigan was on that ship, Volyova said. No, Sir Jarki said, there's no doubt. I know it was him. Afterwards, it became less easy to place him, of course. He may have deliberately blurred his own past to avoid being tracked down by all the enemies he must have made in that time. There are many sightings in many different systems decades apart, but nothing definite. How did he come to be your captain? He turned up centuries later, after several landfalls elsewhere, and dozens of unconfirmed apparitions, on the fringe of the Yellowstone system. He was aging slowly, due to the relativistic effects of starflight, but he was still getting older, and longevity techniques were not as well developed as in our time. Sajaki paused. Much of his body was now a prosthetic. They said that John Brannigan no longer needed a spacesuit when he left his ship, that he breathed vacuum, basked in intolerable heat and quenching cold, and that his sensory range encompassed every spectrum imaginable. They said that little remained of the brain with which he had been born, that his head was merely a dense loom of intermeshed cybernetics, a stew of tiny thinking machines and precious little organic material. And how much of that was true? Perhaps more of it than people wish to believe. There were certainly lies, that he had visited the jugglers on Spindrift years before they were generally discovered, that the aliens had wrought wondrous transformations on what remained of his mind, or that he had met and communicated with at least two sentient species so far unknown to the rest of humanity. He did meet the jugglers eventually, Valjova said in Kuri's direction. Triumvir Sajaki was with him at the time.
That was much later, Sajaki snapped. All that's germane here is his relationship with Calvin.
How did they cross paths? No one really knows, Valjova said. All that we know for sure is that he became injured, either through an accident or some military operation that went wrong. His life wasn't in danger, but he needed urgent help, and to go to one of the official groups in the Yellowstone system would have been suicide. He'd made too many enemies to be able to place his life in the hands of any organization. What he needed were loosely scattered individuals in whom he could place personal trust. Evidently, Calvin was one of them.
Calvin was in touch with Ultra Elements?
Yes, though he would never have admitted so in public. Valjova smiled, a wide toothy crescent opening beneath the bib of her cap. Calvin was young and idealistic then. When this injured man was delivered to him, he saw it as a godsend. Until then he had had no means of exploring his more outlandish ideas. Now he had the perfect subject, the only requirement being total secrecy. Of course, they both gained from it. Calvin was able to try out his radical cybernetic theories on Brannigan, while Brannigan was made well and became something more than he had been before Calvin's work. You might describe it as the perfect symbiotic relationship. You're saying the captain was a guinea pig for that bastard's monstrosities? Sajaki shrugged, the movement puppet-like within his swaddling clothes. That was not how Brannigan saw it. As far as the rest of humanity was concerned, he was already a monster before the accident. What Calvin did was merely take the trend further. Consummate it, if you like. Valjova nodded, although there was something in her expression which suggested she was not quite at ease with her crewmate. And in any case, this was prior to the 80. Calvin's name was unsullied, and among the more overt extremes of ultra-life, Brannigan's transformation was only slightly in excess of the norm. She said it with tart distaste. Carry on. Nearly a century passed before his next encounter with the Sylvest clan, Sajaki said, by which time he was commanding this ship. What happened? He was injured again. Seriously, this time. Gingerly, like someone testing himself against a candle flame, he whisked his fingers across the limiting extent of the captain's silvery growth. The captain's outskirts looked frothing, like the brine left on a rock pool by the retreating tide. Sajaki delicately swabbed his fingers against the front of his jacket, but Kuri could tell that they did not feel clean, that they itched and crawled with sub-epidermal malignants. Unfortunately, Valjova said, Calvin was dead. Of course. He had died during the 80, had in fact been one of the last to lose his corporeality. All right, Corey said, but he died in the process of having his brain scanned into a computer. Couldn't you just steal the recording and persuade it to help you? We would, had that been possible. Sajaki's low voice reverberated from the throated curve of the corridor. His recording, His alpha-level simulation had vanished, and there were no duplicates. The alphas were copy-protected. So basically, Cody said, hoping to shatter the morgue-like atmosphere of the proceedings, you were up Shit Creek without a captain.
Not quite, Volyova said. You see, all this took place during a rather interesting period in Yellowstone's history. Daniel Silvestre had just returned from the Shrouders and was neither insane nor dead. His companion hadn't been so lucky, but her death only added additional poignancy to his heroic return. She halted, then asked with bird-like eagerness, did you ever hear of his 30 days in the wilderness, Curry?
Maybe once. Remind me.
He vanished for a month, a century ago, Sir Jackie said. 1 minute the toast of Stoner society, the next nowhere to be found. There were rumors that he'd gone out of the city dome, jammed on an exosuit, and gone to atone for the sins of his father. Shame it isn't true. Would have been quite touching.
Actually, Sir Jackie nodded at the floor. He came here for a month.
We took him. You kidnapped Dan Silvestre?
Curry almost laughed at the audaciousness of it all. Then she remembered they were talking about the man she was meant to kill. Her impulse to laugh evaporated quickly.
Invited aboard is probably a preferable term, Sir Jackie said, though I admit he didn't have a great deal of choice in the matter.
Let me get this straight, Curry said. You kidnapped Cal's son. What good was that going to do you?
Calvin took a few precautions before he subjected himself to the scanner, Sir Jackie said. The first was simple enough, although it had to be initiated decades before the culmination of the project. Simply put, he arranged to have every subsequent second of his life monitored by recording systems. Every second, waking, sleeping, whatever. Over the years, machines learned to emulate his behavior patterns. Given any situation, they could predict his responses with astonishing accuracy.
Beta-level simulation?
Yes, but a beta-level sim orders of magnitude more complex than any previously created.
By some definitions, Volyova said, it was already conscious. Calvin had already transmigrated. Calvin may or may not have believed that, but he still kept on refining the sim.
It could project an image of Calvin which was so real, so like the actual man, that you had the forceful sense that you were really in his presence. But Calvin took it a step further. There was another mode of insurance available to him.
Which was?
Cloning. Sir Jackie smiled, nodded almost imperceptibly in Volyova's direction.
He cloned himself, she said, using illegal black genetics techniques, calling in favors from some of his shadier clients. Some of them were ultra, you see. Otherwise, we wouldn't know any of this.
Cloning was embargoed technology on Yellowstone. Young colonies almost always outlaw it in the interests of ensuring maximum genetic diversity. But Calvin was cleverer than the authorities and wealthier than those he was forced to bribe. That way he was able to pass off the clone as his son.
Dan, Curry said, the monosyllabic word carving its own angular shape in the refrigerated air. You're telling me Dan is Calvin's clone?
Not that Dan knows any of this, Volyova said. He'd be the last person Calvin wanted to know.
No, Silvestre is as much party to the lie as any of the populace ever were. He thinks he's his own man. He doesn't realize he's a clone.
No, and as time goes by, his chances of ever finding out get smaller and smaller. Beyond Calvin's ultra-allies, almost no one knew, and Calvin set up incentives to keep those that did quiet. There were a few unavoidable weak links. Calvin had no choice but to recruit one of Yellowstone's top geneticists, and Silvestre picked the same man for the Resurgem expedition, not realizing the intimate connection they shared. But I doubt that he's learned the truth since, or even come close to guessing it. But every time he looks in a mirror, he sees himself, not Calvin, Volyova smiled, evidently enjoying the way their revelation was upsetting some of Curie's basic certainties. He was a clone, but that didn't mean he had to resemble Cal down to the last skin pore. The geneticist, Janikin,
knew how to induce cosmetic differences between Cal and Dan's makeup, enough so that people would see only the expected familial traits. Obviously, he also incorporated traits from the woman who was supposed to be Dan's mother, Rosalind Sutton.
The rest was simple, Sir Jackie said.
Cal raised his clone in an environment carefully structured to emulate the surroundings he had known as a boy, even down to the same stimuli at certain periods in the boy's development, because Cal couldn't be sure which of his own personality traits were due to nature or nurture.
All right, Curry said, accepting for the moment that all of this is true. What was the point?
Cal must have known Dan wouldn't follow the same developmental path, no matter how closely he manipulated the boy's life. What about all those decisions that take place in the womb?
Curry shook her head.
It's insane. At the very best, all he'll end up with would be a crude approximation to himself.
I think, Sir Jackie said, that was all that Cal hoped for.
Cal cloned himself as a precaution. He knew the scanning process that he and the other members of the 80 would have to endure would destroy his material body. So he wanted a body to which he could return, if life in the machine turned out not to be to his liking.
And did it?
Maybe, but that was beside the point. At the time of the 80, the retransfer operation was still beyond the technology of the day. There was no real hurry. Cal could always have the clone put in reefer sleep until he needed it, or simply reclone another one from the boy's cells. He was thinking well ahead,
assuming the retransfer ever became possible. Well, Calvin knew it was a long shot. The important thing was that there was a second fallback option apart from retransfer, which was the beta level of simulation. Sir Jarkey's voice had become as slow, cold, and icy as the breezes in the captain's chamber. Although not formally capable of consciousness, it was still an incredibly detailed facsimile of Calvin. Its relative simplicity meant it would be easier to encode its rules into the wetware of Dan's mind, much easier than imprinting something as volatile as the Alpha.
I know the primary recording. The Alpha disappeared, she said. There was no Calvin left to run the show, and I guess Dan began to act a little more independently than Calvin might have wished.
To put it mildly, Sir Jackie said, nodding. The 80 marked the beginning of the decline of the Sylvester Institute. Dan soon escaped its shackles, more interested in the Shrouder enigma than cybernetic immortality. He kept possession of the beta-level sim, though he never realized its exact significance. He thought of it more as an heirloom than anything else. The Triumvir smiled. I think he would have destroyed it had he realized what it represented, which was his own annihilation. Understandable, Curry thought. The beta-level simulation was like a trapped demon waiting to inhabit a new host body, not properly conscious, but still dangerously potent by virtue of the subtle ingenuity with which it mimicked true intelligence.
Cal's precautionary measure was still useful to us, Sir Jackie said.
There was enough of Cal's expertise encoded in the beta to mend the captain. All we had to do was persuade Dan to let Calvin temporarily inhabit his mind and body. Dan must have suspected something when it worked so easily.
It was never easy, Sir Jackie admonished.
Far from it. The periods when Cal took over were more akin to some kind of violent possession. Motor control was a problem. In order to suppress Dan's own personality, we had to give him a cocktail of neuroinhibitors, which meant that when Cal finally got through, the body he found himself in was already half paralyzed by our drugs. It was like a brilliant surgeon performing an operation by giving orders to a drunk, and by all accounts, it wasn't the most pleasant of experiences for Dan. Quite painful, he said. But it worked. Just. But that was a century ago, and now it's time for another visit to the doctor.
Your vials, said the ordinator. One of the wimpled aides from Pascal's party stepped forward, brandishing a vial identical in size and shape to the one which Sylvester removed from his pocket. They were not the same color. The fluid in Pascal's vial had been tinted red,
against the yellow hue of Sylvest's. Similar darkish fronds of material orbited within. The ordinator took both vials and held them aloft for a few moments, before placing them side by side on the table, in clear view of the audience. "We are ready to begin the marriage," she said. She then performed the customary duty of asking if there were anyone present who had any bioethical reasons as to why the marriage should not take place. There was, of course, no objection. But in that odd, loaded moment of branching possibilities, Sylvest noted a veiled woman in the audience reach into a purse and uncap a dainty, jeweled-topped amber perfume jar. "Daniel Sylvest," said the ordinator, "do you take this woman to be your wife, under resurgam law, until such time as this marriage is annulled under this or any prevailing legal system?"
"I do," Sylvest said.
She repeated the question to Pascal.
"I do," Pascal said.
"Then let the bonding be done." Ordinator Massinger took the wedding gun from the mahogany box and snapped it open. She loaded the reddish vial, the one Pascal's party had delivered, into the breech, then reclosed the instrument. Status Entoptics briefly haloed it. Girardio placed his hand on Sylvest's upper arm, steadying him as the ordinator pressed the conic end of the instrument against his temple, just above his eye level. Sylvest had been right when he told Girardio that the ceremony was not painful, but neither was it entirely pleasant. What it was a sudden flowering of intense cold, as if liquid helium were being blasted into his cortex. The discomfort was brief, however, and the thumb-sized bruise on his skin would not last more than a few days. The brain's immune system was weak by comparison with the body as a whole, and Pascal's cells, floating as they did in a stew of helper medicines, would soon bond with Sylvest's own. The volume was tiny, no more than 0.1% of the brain's mass, but the transplanted cells carried the indelible impression of their last host, ghost threads of holographically distributed memory and personality. The ordinator removed the spent red vial and slotted the yellow one in its place. It was Pascal's first wedding under the stoner custom, and her trepidation was not well disguised. Girardio held her hands as the ordinator delivered the neural material, Pascal visibly flinching as it happened. Sylvest had let Girardio think the implant was permanent, but this was never the case. The neural tissue was tagged with harmless radioisotope trace elements, enabling it to be rooted out and destroyed, if necessary, by divorce viruses. So far, Sylvest had never taken that option, and imagined he never would, no matter how many marriages down the line he was. He carried the smoky essences of all his wives, as they carried him, as he would carry Pascal. Indeed, on the faintest level, Pascal herself now carried traces of his previous wives. That was the stoner way. The ordinator carefully replaced the wedding gun in its box. "According to resurgam law," she began, "the marriage is now formalized. You may..." Which was when the perfume hit Janikin's birds. The woman who had uncapped the amber jar was gone, her seat glaringly vacant. Fragrant autumnal, the odor from the jar made Sylvest think of crushed leaves. He wanted to sneeze. Something was wrong. The room flashed turquoise blue, as if 100 pastel fans had just opened. Peacock's tails springing open. A million tinted eyes. The air turned grey.
"Get down!" Girardio screamed. He was scrabbling madly at his neck. There was something hooked in it, something tiny and barbed.
Numbly, Sylvest looked at his tunic and saw half a dozen comma-shaped barbs clinging to it. They had not broken the fabric, but he dared not touch them.
"Assassination tools!"
Girardio shouted. He slumped under the table, dragging Sylvest and his daughter with him. The auditorium was chaos now, a frenzied mass of agitated people trying to escape.
"Janekin's birds were primed," Girardio said, virtually screaming in Sylvest's ear. "Poison darts in their tails!"
"You're hit," Pascal said, too stunned for her voice to carry much emotion.
Light and smoke burst over their heads. They heard screams. Out of the corner of his eye, Sylvest saw the perfume woman holding a sleekly evil pistol in a two-handed grip. She was dousing the audience with it, its fanged barrels spitting cold pulses of Bowser energy. The float cam swept round her, dispassionately recording the carnage. Sylvester had never seen a weapon like the one the woman used. He knew it could not have been manufactured on Resurgium, which left only two possibilities. Either it had arrived from Yellowstone with the original settlement, or it had been sold by Remiliod, the trader who had passed through the system since the coup.
Glass, amaranthine glass that had survived 10,000 centuries, broke shrilly above. Like pieces of shattered toffee, it crashed down in jagged shards into the audience.
Sylvester watched, powerless, as the ruby planes buried themselves in flesh, like frozen lightning. The terrified were already screaming loud enough to drown out the cries of those in pain. What remained of Girardio's security team was mobilizing, but terribly slowly. Four of the militia were down, their faces punctured by the barbs. One had reached the seating, struggling with the woman who had the gun. Another was opening fire with his own sidearm, scything through Jennekin's birds. Girardio, meanwhile, was groaning. His eyes were rolling bloodshot, hands grasping at thin air.
"We have to get out of here," Sylvester said, shouting in Pascal's ear.
She seemed still dazed from the neural transfer, blearily oblivious to what was happening.
"But my father, he's gone."
Sylvester eased Girardio's dead weight onto the cold floor of the temple, careful to keep behind the safety of the table.
"The barb was meant to kill Pascal. There's nothing we can do for him. If we stay, we'll just end up following him."
Girardio croaked something. It might have been "go," or it might only have been a final, senseless exhalation.
"We can't leave him," Pascal said.
"If we don't, his killers end up winning."
Tears slashed her face.
"Where can we go?"
He looked around frantically. Smoke from concussion shells was filling the chamber, probably from Girardio's own people. It was settling in lazy pastel spirals, like scarves tossed from a dancer. Just when it was almost too dark to see, the room plunged into total blackness. The lights beyond the temple had obviously been turned off or destroyed. Pascal gasped. His eyes slipped into infrared mode, almost without him having to think about it.
"I can still see," he whispered to her. "As long as we stay together, you don't have to worry about the darkness."
Praying that the danger from the birds was gone, Sylvester rose slowly to his feet. The temple glowed in gray-green heat. The perfume woman was dead, a fist-sized hot hole in her side. Her amber jar was smashed at her feet. He guessed it had been some kind of hormonal trigger, keyed to receptors Jennekin had put in the birds. He had to have been part of it. He looked, but Jennekin was dead. A tiny dagger sat in his chest, trailing hot rivulets down his brocade jacket. Sylvester grabbed Pascal and shoved her along the ground towards the exit, a vaulted archway gilded with amaranthine figurines and bas-relief graphic forms. It seemed that the perfume woman had been the only assassin actually present, if one discounted Jennekin. But now her friends were entering, garbed in camelioflage. They wore close-fitting breather masks and infrared goggles. He pushed Pascal behind a jumble of upturned tables.
"They're looking for us," he hissed, "but they probably think we're already dead."
Girardio's surviving security people had fallen back and taken up defensive positions, kneeling within the fan-shaped auditorium. It was no match. The newcomers carried much heavier weapons, heavy Bowser rifles. Girardio's militia countered with low-yield lasers and projectile weapons, but the enemy were cutting them apart with blithe, impersonal ease. At least half the audience were unconscious or dead. They had caught the brunt of the peacock venom salvo. Hardly the most surgically precise of assassination tools, those birds, but they had been allowed into the auditorium completely unchecked. Sylvester observed that two were still alive, despite what he had at first imagined. Still triggered by trace molecules of the perfume which remained aloft, their tails were flicking open and shut like the fans of nervous courtesans.
"Did your father carry a weapon?"
Sylvester said, instantly regretting his use of the past tense. "I mean, since the coup."
"I don't think so," Pascal said.
Of course not. Girardio would never have confided such a thing to her. Quickly, Sylvester felt around the man's still body, hoping to find the padded hardness of a weapon beneath his ceremonial clothes. "Nothing. We'll have to do without," Sylvester said, as if the stating of this fact would somehow alleviate the problem it encapsulated. "They're going to kill us if we don't run," he said finally. "Into the labyrinth?" "They'll see us," Sylvester said.
"But maybe they won't think it's us," Pascal said. "They might not know you can see in the dark." Though she was effectively blind, she managed to look him square in the face. Her mouth was open, an almost circular vacancy of expression or hope. "Let me say goodbye to my father first."
She found his body in the darkness, kissed him for the last time. Sylvester looked to the exit. At that moment, the soldier guarding it was hit by a shot from what remained of Girardio's militia. The masked figure crumpled, his body heat pooling liquidly into the floor around his body, spreading smoky white maggots of thermal energy into the stonework. The way was clear, for the moment. Pascal found his hand, and together they began to run.